This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg. I'm a senior fellow for policy studies here at the Family Research Council in Washington.
My name is Chris Gasek, and I'm also a senior fellow here at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C.
We're filling in today, once again today, for Tony Perkins, who is down in Louisiana at his home, still dealing with the after effects of the Louisiana flooding. But we have a special announcement. Tony is actually going to join us on Washington Watch with Tony Perkins in our second segment. So at 22 minutes after the hour, we will be hearing from Tony the latest on what's happening down there in Louisiana. I guess he had a special visitor at his church today where they're coordinating the
quite a lot of activity.
Efforts. Yeah, a lot going on. Several special visitors, I should say. But we will get to that at 22 minutes after the hour. Our first guest, however, today is the author of a new book about a topic that's been the subject of a lot of discussion. Kenneth Timmerman is the author of a book called Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. This is available on Amazon, and I'm going to let my colleague Chris Gasek take over the interview with Ken Timmerman.
Mr. Timmerman, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I just want to know if I've seen many interviews with you about other books and also about Benghazi, and just have a great deal of respect for the range of topics on which you've written. And so I kind of approach this with some a little bit of trepidation because you know so much about the topic, especially Benghazi. So, but just make a quick observation. I mean, to me, you know, looking at Benghazi, and one of the things that I when I saw this book and I heard an interview with you, the thing that, you know, Benghazi to me has sort of like three parts. There's sort of like, you know, all the stuff going on before it. You know, was there enough security at the mission in Benghazi? You know, all of these sorts of issues. There's exactly what happened that day and whether we responded correctly and those sorts of topics, right? And then you have the aftermath. And to me, the sort of the central fact about all that was the lying about what happened and this about this video and the Obama administration's kind of just concerted effort to perpetuate this lie. And how, to me, that was because I was interested in the politics of what happened in a way more than sort of the other sides of things. It struck me as just an incredibly shocking thing that, for example, any prime minister in Britain, a government would have fallen. Just no way that they would have been able to withstand it once it was, you know, like, for example, even now when it was shown that they were completely lying about this. And so it was a relief to see a book come out that where you have sort of gone and back and really sort of talked to the principals involved, the man who made the video and an actress who was in the video. And I was wondering if you could just sort of tell us how you came to write the book, because I know you've been involved in this or interested in this topic for a while.
Deception really kind of takes apart all of those lies and looks where they came from. It looks at how the video went viral, and you find out, for example, that the first left-wing media reports that mention the video as being responsible for the attacks in Benghazi, and by the way, I think that was all planted by the State Department. All right, let's get that clear. The State Department planted that information in the left-stream media friends of theirs. But those initial reports all pointed to a YouTube channel, Chris, that had 405 views. I can remember the time. I can remember the time looking the next day. Where's this video? Where is this video that they're all talking about? It was you couldn't find it easily. The search terms were obscure, and the reason was that it hadn't yet gone viral. So that posed a problem, and what I found out researching this was that the State Department and the administration reached out to a contractor. A contractor set up this special YouTube channel, News Politics Now, and promoted it using some very sophisticated marketing techniques so that by the second day, they had over a million hits. And then I have a chart in the book, and you can see how it goes up day by day. And finally, after a week, they've got like 10 million views of this video. So now it really has gone viral, and it starts to cause real trouble around the Middle East, right?
Right.
And then, after they get to about 10 million hits or so, that special YouTube channel set up by the State Department and CIA contractor is wiped out. Literally, it's taken down, and all trace of it vanishes from the Internet, except for what we were able to resurrect through the archives. So that was an active measure. That wasn't just a deception operation, but that was really what we would call in the intelligence business during the Cold War an active measure of disinformation.
And this is being conducted by the United States government against the American people.
Absolutely correct. It's very important to emphasize that, against the people of the United States of America.
So, I mean, when you discovered this, this has made this even more shocking because, I mean, the facts that we were essentially dealing with were the ones that were, I mean, pretty well publicly known, and they were bad enough. But this was sort of another level at which we're finding out about how – what I find so amazing about this is the speed with which they were able to put all this together and come up with just this level of fabrication and deceit. Doesn't it sort of just stun you?
Well, they had real pros doing it. we know now that from the emails that Hillary Clinton was trying to not release to the public or to Congress, we know that she was being advised by Sidney Blumenthal, a former Clinton White House media advisor. He's the one who came up with the vast right-wing conspiracy. Now, I got to tell you, I have a little pride of having been involved in that in the 1990s at the American Spectator. But anyhow, he came up with this vast right-wing conspiracy back in the 90s, and now we have memos that he sent to Hillary Clinton on the night of September 11th, laying out this whole strategy of how to blame the attacks in Benghazi on this YouTube video. Now, the maker of the YouTube video, I went and interviewed him as well, Nikola Vasily Nikula, he's a Coptic Christian, and you'll find, in a way, he's kind of a pathetic character. I mean, he really becomes a victim of this administration. He becomes the first victim of Islamic Sharia blasphemy laws, put in prison in America because he insulted the so-called prophet of Islam. Unbelievable. You would think, you know, that could never happen here. Well, it has happened here. It's happened already. So this was a very sophisticated operation, comrade, and it was done by some very talented people.
Now, one thing I've never quite understood, and forgive me, I am one of these people who has not followed the Benghazi story in detail, but if I understand correctly, the essence of it, they chose to blame this attack in Benghazi on sort of a spontaneous response to this video instead of what it really was, which was a planned terrorist attack. But why? I mean, what difference would it make to them, to the Obama administration?
Well, it made a huge difference because if they had acknowledged that they had faced a planned terrorist attack, the entire re-election narrative for Obama collapses. Remember, his whole point was Osama is dead, GM is alive. We have beaten Islamic terrorism. Never use the word Islamic terrorism. We have defeated violent extremism and restored the American economy. Well, if we're getting attacked by jihadi terrorists, who some of whom are close to al-Qaeda or actually belong to an al-Qaeda affiliate in Benghazi, that means this whole narrative is a sham. And I think they were very, very concerned about that 56 days away from the presidential election in 2012.
So, in a sense, they wanted to have people believe that the reason these Americans died in Benghazi was because of this Coptic Christian who made this film, rather than because of the terrorists that they had not been able to defeat in the Middle East?
Absolutely correct. And there are a couple more reasons, too. But it was the Coptic Christian. They also were trying to blame a conservative Christian pastor named Terry Jones in Florida. And you'll see in the book, I go through this a little bit, Hillary Clinton and her staff were absolutely obsessed with this guy. He's the one who burned the Quran on the anniversary of September 11th. She was all over him. There's tons of email traffic about this guy. And they were actually wrong. They thought he made the movie in the beginning, and they were wrong. But the third thing involved, and this is just as important, is that they were trying desperately to create a deception, a cover story, to take deflect attention away from what was actually happening in Benghazi. In other words, we were shipping arms to terrorists, and they didn't want the American public to be looking at that. They wanted the public to be looking at the YouTube video.
Let me ask you something, because one of the things that then happens is the story emerges, and Susan Rice, who is the ambassador to the United Nations, right? She goes on TV and she just repeatedly lies like six or seven times that Sunday. I mean, it's just she's kind of like going on like an Olympic lying tour of all the news shows, right? But so people kind of remember that. But if I think I'm correct about this, and I just want to make sure. But President Obama went to the United Nations and essentially lied about this too, right?
Absolutely correct. Yes, he did. And I will say I have a kind of softer judgment of Susan Rice than you do. I don't think she thought she was lying. She was repeating what okay. she had been briefed to say. It was the briefers who lied to her. And by the way, the chief briefer, the man who did the final edits on the talking points that were crafted for Susan Rice, was a guy named Mike Morrell, who was the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and who has come out and endorsed Hillary Clinton. Now, this is a guy who lies repeatedly, has lied in public, he's lied to Congress, he's lied under oath, and now he's touted as some kind of wonderful national security guru that we should all look up to. I think the guy should be in jail, frankly.
I'm glad you pointed that out about Susan Rice. That's interesting to know. But the key thing to me is that Obama, who clearly knew what was going on,
yes.
I mean, stood in the well of the UN in that, you know, the big General Assembly room giving a speech and at least, you know, made a pretty direct reference to this film. I mean, he didn't go into detail, but he made it clear that you know, everybody understood what he was talking about, right?
Crystal clear. Yes. He said the future does not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam.
Right, the prophet of Islam.
Let me ask you a question. What Christian would use terminology like that?
that's a very good question. Well,
just say it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Kenneth Timmerman, author of Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video, Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. It's available now on Amazon. And I give you the full background story of the Benghazi deception. Thanks for joining us, Ken Timmerman.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I enjoyed it. Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We'll be back here with Tony Perkins right after this break.
Does the U.S. Senate have a responsibility to confirm anyone that President Obama nominates to fill Justice Scalia's vacated seat? After the passing of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, an intense political debate has emerged around this crucial question. The Constitution does not require conditions or limitations on the manner in which the Senate must act if the president nominates. Family Research Council believes that the Senate should not consider or deliberate on any nominee President Obama puts forward to fill Justice Scalia's vacated seat. This is because the president has consistently nominated Supreme Court justices and federal judges who view the Constitution as a malleable political instrument instead of a text with a defined meaning based on the consensus held by the Founding Fathers. To learn more about this critical issue, including 8 helpful questions and answers, visit frc.org/supremecourt. That's frc.org/Supreme Court.
With a ministry opportunity, here's Steve Tiber.
8 Days of Hope 12 will be going to Black River, South Carolina. Last year in October, 25 inches of rain fell in the state, causing $22 billion of damage. And now you and I get a chance to go to South Carolina this fall and encourage people who feel like they've been forgotten. We have 70 homes out of the 250 homes that we're looking to work in that need brand new roofs. If you've ever done any roofing whatsoever, a couple roofs in your life, or maybe you've led a roofing crew or worked in construction, consider coming to 8 Days of Hope. We're looking for plumbers, carpenters, painters. Man, there's something for everybody. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com. We hope to see you there.
Be the hands and feet of Jesus. Visit 8daysofhope.com. Please pray for this relief effort and for the families affected by this flood. And if you can't volunteer but would still like to help, donations are also needed. You can give and learn more at 8daysofhope.com.
We're in the financial business. We manage a couple of trusts and some estates, and of course, our own monies too.
Courtney Trotter talks about the charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation.
I understand annuities about as much as anyone, I guess, can. So I just felt the charitable gift annuity was a win-win situation for many people that still are generating income and still have assets. Because you never know when you may have to draw down on something like that. And if you don't ever have to, then it's even a better gift to get to a really good foundation like AFA. A very solid investment, a good way to help do the Lord's work, and it's there to help us as well.
Find out if the charitable gift annuity can work for you by calling the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg.
My name is Chris Gasek.
And we're filling in for Tony today here on Washington Watch. But we are hoping to hear from Tony in just a few minutes directly from Louisiana. Tony lives in Louisiana, of course, and his home and his family were affected by the flooding this week down there. And he's also been he and his church have been very active in the relief efforts for their neighbors, the members of their church and the whole community, in terms of trying to provide relief. And in fact, his church has become a base of operations for Samaritan's Purse, the Christian charity that relief charity operated by founded and operated by Franklin Graham, the Reverend Franklin Graham, and. Chris and I were just sitting here during the break talking about how, we were kind of surprised watching TV today during the day, and there was some discussion of the Trump campaign and that Donald Trump and Mike Pence were going to make a visit to Louisiana, something that that President Obama had declined to do. And all of a sudden on the screen, we see a picture of Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Tony Perkins, Franklin Graham, and Congressman Steve Scalise, who's from Louisiana, standing at the front of the Greenwell Springs Baptist Church, which is Tony's church, talking about the relief efforts there. But ironically, in that first video, they didn't play the audio. The Fox announcers were talking about Trump being there and not actually showing the audio. But it was a big event there. Tony's been doing interviews in between trying to handle this, and he was just on the Fox Business Network. We're trying to get him on to talk with us, and he should be with us any minute now. But we ask your continued prayers for Tony and his family, for the personal impact that the flooding has had on them and their home, but also for everyone affected by the flooding there in Louisiana. And if you would like to help with the relief efforts, we will connect you to Samaritan's Purse and the work that they're doing there. If you want to visit, you can visit the radio show website, tonyperkins.com. There's a link there, or the regular Family Research Council website at frc.org/flood. And we can connect you in that way to how you can help. There are a number of ways you can help. You can help, of course, by your prayers. We encourage all of our Christian listeners, and I imagine the bulk of the listeners to this show probably are Christians, to be earnest in prayer for all those affected by this, what the FEMA or the federal government, I think, is saying, right, the worst natural disaster since Hurricane Sandy 4 years ago in the Northeast. And you can give financially, of course, to the work of Samaritan's Purse. That'll be a big help. But they are also looking for volunteers because,
right,
the relief efforts they have going on down there are going to be very labor intensive. People have to literally be able to clear out their houses. They have to be able to, you know, empty out the furniture that's been destroyed. And they have to be able to, you know, tear out drywall and so forth. So we have Tony now. Tony, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Peter. Good to talk with you. How are you doing?
We're doing okay. So we only have a few minutes with you. I'll just let you take over. You had a big day down there today. We were just commenting that we saw on Fox this morning, we originally saw video but no audio of you with some special guests at your church. Tell us about that.
Well, Donald Trump and Mike Pence came down to Louisiana today, actually came to our church where Samaritan's Purse is set up and beginning the relief effort of helping people clean out their homes where we're serving food, area that was hit very hard by this flooding. And I had reached out to the Trump campaign yesterday because of the really almost media blackout on what's happening down here because it's so intense and the the depth and breadth of this is astonishing. And Donald Trump, as I rode around with him and Mike, as we drove through many of the neighborhoods that were affected, they were amazed at the extent of the devastation. We got out, we talked to a number of families, and I think it was very important because he saw firsthand, and it was very encouraging to the people, given the fact that the president has continued his vacation and basically ignored the problems down here, that, you know, not that people are looking for anything from the government. The nonprofit world is engaged and involved, but it's good to know that people care, and it draws attention to the putting a priority on that, which hopefully will lead to more people volunteering and coming to Louisiana. And we really need that, especially for the next few weeks, to get things moving, to help people get their own homes together so that they can then better help their neighbors. And so we're encouraging people to join with Samaritan's Purse and volunteer and come down, and they can find out more at Samaritan's First website, which I'm sure we've got a link at tonyperkins.com.
That's
and
right.
We're housing those volunteers at our church. And if you want to come down and get a taste of some Louisiana food and culture and help out some Louisiana folks, now's the time to do it.
Well, we just mentioned that this is the relief process is going to be very labor intensive. So you're needing not only people's money and prayers, but people's labor to come down there. Can you tell us, Tony, have the floodwaters pretty well receded now, or are there places that are still underwater?
There are places in South Louisiana, south from where we're in the real South Louisiana. It's moving its way down, and there's still some places where there are still floodwaters. The floodwaters have receded where we are. They're gone. We're now pretty much dry, still soggy. Occasional flash flood warnings that are coming as a result of just basically saturation. But it hasn't rained. Didn't rain yesterday or today, so we've had 2 days without rain. And so the worst is over here from the standpoint of the weather. Now it's just as you mentioned, the labor intensive. We had to tear out our complete house, gut it. It is a laborious task, and it's just everybody. It's happening. Yeah. It's not just a house here and there. It's almost everybody.
And
church,
and
half of our congregation displaced.
Wow. And Tony, are you and your family still living in your motorhome?
Yes, we're going to be on an extended camping trip at our front yard. So I don't know if the kids are looking forward to it, but I'm looking forward to a little family time.
Yeah, you'll get really close. Well, thanks for joining us and giving us that update, Tony, and we'll continue to pray for you down there in Louisiana, and visit frc.org/flood or tonyperkins.com to see how you can help. Thanks, Tony. We'll be right back.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, it looks like gold falling off its two-week high. We got some earnings reports out of John Deere. John Deere earnings were up, and of course, you've heard me say earnings are pretty irrelevant, particularly today, as we see so much financial engineering going on in and around earnings. So earnings pretty good, but net sales from equipment operations came in at about $5.8 billion, down from $6.8 billion. That is significant. They're still profitable, but nonetheless, we are seeing some farm equipment and other areas of John Deere continuing to fall off. It tells us a little bit about the broader economy. That's why I bring it up. Obviously, as we think about commodity prices, what is going on in that arena, what is happening with revenue streams from some of our farmers and ranchers, generally, when that is up significantly, or generally when they begin to feel fairly comfortable with that revenue stream and comfortable with the future of what they are doing, they buy new equipment. And we have not seen that in at least 4 years. That's beginning to catch up with companies like John Deere. European shares falling. Looks like automakers over there are struggling. And there's a lot of evidence right now that the Federal Reserve is not likely to raise interest rates before the election. But there are still several Federal Reserve governors that are pushing for a September rate hike.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Tony, as you just heard, and if you were listening in the last segment, is still in Louisiana working on flood relief, both with his own home and with all those in the community affected by the flooding in Louisiana. Today, he hosted Donald Trump and Mike Pence and Franklin Graham at his church, working closely with Franklin Graham's organization, Samaritan's Purse, down there. But now we want to move on to an issue and a court decision that was released yesterday dealing with the transgender issue. I know on Wednesday we talked a lot about this, but there was some breaking news. About a case in Michigan, and we have with us the attorney who represented a funeral home that was sued by the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission of the federal government. His name's Doug Wardlow. Doug, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thank you.
Give us a brief explanation of what this case was and what the judge decided yesterday.
Absolutely. So this case, like I said, it involved a funeral home in Michigan, three funeral homes, Harris Funeral Homes. And Harris Funeral Homes is run by Tom Rost. And Tom Rost is a devout Christian, and he follows the biblical teaching that human sexuality is a God-given gift, and it is immutable. And therefore, he had a sex-specific dress code in place at his funeral homes. Now, one of his employees, who was always biological male, told him at some point in 2013 that he wanted to go on vacation and then come back to work, and when he came back, he would be dressing as a woman at work, and that would violate Rost's sex-specific dress code. And so the employee was discharged for violating the sex-specific dress code. The employee filed the charge with the EEOC of sex discrimination, and this is one of two cases that the Obama administration brought in 2014 in an attempt to really do an end run around Congress and redefine sex in Title VII's prohibition of sex discrimination in employment to cover gender identity as well. They brought two cases, one in Florida against an eye clinic, and I think that one settled, and then there's this one. And so what the judge did yesterday is he granted the funeral home our motion for summary judgment and dismissed the case on the grounds that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act prevents the federal government from forcing Tom Rost to permit an employee to dress as a member of the opposite sex while on the job representing the funeral home. So this is a huge victory for religious liberty, and it means that government can't use Title VII to coerce private employers to abandon their sincerely held religious beliefs.
Well, that's great news. And just for those who aren't aware, Title VII is a portion of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which banned employment discrimination on the basis of race and also on the basis of sex. Now, one of the key arguments that we've made is that when Congress passed that law in 1964, they were not – when they said they wanted to protect sex as a protected category, it is – probably indisputable that they meant biological sex, that they weren't talking about someone's self-chosen gender identity. And fortunately, the judge in this case agreed with that entirely. Isn't that correct? That gender identity is not a part of sex discrimination.
That's right. The judge clearly held that Title VII, at least in the Sixth Circuit, does not include a transgender status or gender identity, and then he delivered us the victory under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Now there is kind of an alternate theory about sex stereotyping that's been offered, which is where the judge maybe gave more credence to that. But still, the final decision was made under, as you said, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And he frequently cited the Hobby Lobby case, which we've talked a lot about here at Family Research Council. Maybe mention how the precedent of Hobby Lobby helped in the outcome of this case.
Well, absolutely. So Hobby Lobby established the principle that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies to closely held corporations. That is, in the context of the contraception mandate, HHS mandate. And so that case, this ruling by this judge yesterday, Judge Cox, is the first time a federal judge has extended the holding of Hobby Lobby and applied RFRA to the Title VII context and applied it to block the application of Title VII in such a way that would coerce a privately held business from violating its religious beliefs.
So it certainly is encouraging that the courts have said that businesses can exercise religious beliefs as well as individuals, and it's encouraging, I think, in this case that they gave a fairly expansive interpretation to the private owner's religious beliefs. It even though that wasn't a religious corporation, it wasn't a church affiliated thing or something
right.
like that, that he still had legitimate religious exercise rights.
That's right. It's very clear now that you don't lose your religious exercise rights just because you go into a private business, a for-profit business. And it's also very positive. The judge did push back at the sex stereotyping theory with respect to transgender people that claim to be a gender identity other than their biological sex. What was happening here is the EEOC was basically telling the funeral home that you have to allow this employee to dress as a stereotypical woman at the workplace. So the judge said you cannot eradicate sex stereotypes in the workplace by insisting on sex stereotypes in the workplace.
Right. That was an interesting twist to the story. Well, thanks, Doug Wardlow, for joining us. A big victory in a court case in Michigan for a Christian funeral home owner. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back after this break.
Since I've led tours for many years to the Holy Land, Israel, many people ask me, what's your favorite place to go? I have two, really. The Garden Tomb and Calvary, and the Sea of Galilee. Now, I like all the places we stop along the way in Israel, but those two places in particular are very special and meaningful. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We'll be going to all the places you've read about in the Bible since you were a child. It's going to be a very special tour of Israel, the Holy Land, March 9 through 17, 2017. We're taking a direct flight from New York to Tel Aviv. For all the information on this tour, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5 and leave us your name and your address and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, option 5. Or visit the website twholyland.com.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hey, Pastor, have you always wanted to return to school? Have you always wanted a richer understanding of Christian thought? Wesley Biblical Seminary is for you. Hello, I'm John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary. With physical campuses in Jackson, Mississippi and Greenwood, Indiana, Wesley Biblical Seminary offers life-transforming theological education. Apply today at wbs.edu. Wesley Biblical Seminary, preach the word, reach the world. wbs.edu.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger. A group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing health care for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg.
I'm Chris Gasek.
Here at Family Research Council in Washington. And we've been happy to host on Tony's behalf for the last 3 days as Tony deals with the aftermath of the flooding there in Louisiana. We've dealt with some heavy subjects in the last couple of days. We're going to end the week on a little bit lighter note, I think, with a friend and colleague of ours who's also an author. Sarah Parshall Perry is coalition coordinator for Family Research Council, but she is also a mother and a lawyer and author of two books, which are both available on Amazon. Two books about motherhood. One is called Sand in My Sandwich and Other Motherhood Messes I'm Learning to Love. And the second one is called Mommy Needs a Raise Because Quitting's Not an Option. So I think you get a sense. Now, I want to say something about Sarah. I've worked with Sarah a little bit. Chris has probably worked with her more. I have the sense, I've always had the sense that she's very smart and very funny with a good sense of humor. But that has been reinforced by my exposure to these two books, even though I haven't read them, just reading excerpts from them. So, Sarah, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Peter and Chris. Glad to be with both of you.
Well, it's great to have you on. So why don't you tell us what prompted you to write these books about motherhood?
Well, you know, I have very unique children. Everyone thinks that their children are unique, but mine were unique enough apparently to warrant the creation of two separate books about them. So until our reality show is created, this will have to do. So the first book that I wrote, Sand in My Sandwich, was really a series of blog posts about our journey in getting both of my sons diagnosed with autism. And this was something that came along very early in our parenting journey. And I had written for quite a number of years for two different ministries about what it was like to have children who had invisible disabilities, those that weren't seen to the naked eye, and what that was like in a church environment and how we could really provide resources for them. And as I wrote, I discovered that there was the creation of the shell of this book, and I realized that the series of occurrences and the level of difficulty our family has experienced was really fairly unique, and it became the journey of how God was using my very unique children and the disordered nature of our lives to make himself very visible. And then when I wrote the second actually became the prequel to the first, because it was the stage I went through before I was at home with children, and that sort of psychic hurdle I had to get over, because as you know, going through so much education and carrying so much debt, when you make the decision to say, I think I'm going to stay home for a while, you know, that's not an easy decision to make. So it was an examination on what the nature of value and worth was in the profession of motherhood, because it really is, in its own right, a very unique job. So mm-hmm. one sort of preceded the other in reverse order, but they were two phases of the same journey, the first being how I got there, and the second, what I learned through the process.
So now, how many children do you have now, Sarah?
I have three. Noah is my oldest at 12. He is making the middle school transition. Jesus, take the wheel. second is Grace. She is 9 and going on 19. So those teenage years should be fun. And then Jesse is my youngest. He's the tail on the dog at 7, but really is probably the biggest presence in the house. We like to call him the destroyer. So that will give you a sense of his personality.
Great. Well, what would you say? I mean, what would you say? So you have a blog. I want to put in a little plug. Do you still have a blog that you write about
I
these?
I do, actually. I write for specialneedsparenting.net. And we've just come under the heading of an organization, a wonderful organization called Team Ministry. And they specifically minister to families who are dealing with these very unique invisible disabilities. So everything from early onset bipolar to ADHD to autism, we find the church to be very prepared to deal with our brothers and sisters who have visible disabilities. Those who are quadriplegic or who are suffering with Down syndrome, the church is ready and able and willing to minister to those individuals. But because the very nature of autism and these other disorders makes them chameleon-like, it is sometimes a challenge for the church to know how to reach them individually. So specialneedsparenting.net is really, it's been a fabulous resource for individuals. And we write from all over the country. All of us come from unique backgrounds, and we offer very unique stories, but it's a fabulous resource for individuals who are looking both for churches with disability ministries and who want to read about people whose experiences mirror theirs, because a lot of this journey is really being able to communicate with other people and understand the nature of what we're going through and to understand how it all fits in God's divine plan.
Now, In the book Mommy Needs a Raise, you have a section where you talk about the Donner Party. Now, this is a little bit dramatic. For people who aren't aware of the history, the Donner Party were pioneers who were trying to go to California, and they basically got stranded in the Sierra Nevada mountains in the winter.
Right.
And
in like 1846.
They're famous for ending up engaging in cannibalism to survive.
And now I will say, Peter, we haven't gotten to the point where we've eaten anybody.
Well, I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to hear that. We'll just get that
there
on
there wasn't
record.
A fourth child that.
there's an element of survivalism and essential surprise that I felt was appropriate to open the book with. So, one doesn't anticipate opening a book on motherhood with a recounting of the Donner Party experience. But again, for those who are not so familiar with their sort of mid-19th century westward expansion, they made the unfortunate decision to take what was then a new route called the Hastings Cutoff. And that went through the Utah Wasatch Mountains. And it added about 150 miles to their journey. And they thought it was actually a shortcut. And during this time of taking what they believed was a shortcut, they were caught by a very heavy, very early, unexpected snowfall. And that, of course, as we know now, resulted in the cannibalism. And my point in referring to the Donner Party was really that there is this element of absence of preparation, that even for someone who has spent a great number of years in school, who believes that she can be prepared for anything, that parenthood is completely surprising. And there are certain elements you can prepare for. You know, I was the individual who had the 3-page single-spaced birth plan with the cartoon source. I don't know why those were important, but I believed it would be for the entertainment of the nurses, and they outright laughed at me when I handed it to them. So I had no idea. I went in thinking, this is going to be something that I'm completely going to ace. You know, I'm very typical type A, firstborn, overachiever. I'm going to go in, I'm going to manage everything perfectly and appropriately. And, you know, that is a funny way of going, you know, I see this personality trait that might also be a weakness in your personality. It might be something you struggle with. So I'm going to flip the script a little bit. So from that point on, I like to say Noah was really the catalyst for the sequential falling apart of the rest of my life. And he taught me some very unique lesson. So the Donner Party was an exercise in survival for them. And there are some days as a parent where you think to yourself, you know, if I just survive by getting by, I need to make peace with the essential elements, not try to achieve so hard, and recognize that there is a divine design behind the greatest job that we have.
Sarah, I think one of the future books that you're going to write, because obviously you're not going to stop once you've started. It's like an addiction. But I can clearly foresee that, like, you know, like volume 7 is going to be Grace's ongoing struggle with PTSD.
Oh, geez, trust me, she is not struggling because she is the only child in the middle who is a girl and neurotypical, as I like to call it. She is not in any way at a loss. She is the loudest of my children. She makes her presence definitively known. And, you know, because she's the only girl, she's got Matt wrapped around her finger. So she's made quite sure to make her presence known to everyone around her. But every child is so incredibly unique. And this book that I wrote, the second book that I wrote, Bobby Needs a Raise, was really driven towards answering the question that I wanted to find answered in somebody else's book. So where is the value in motherhood? We understand that we as individuals are ontological beings, our individual selves. We have worth. We understand that we're created with worth. It is because God loves us and we are put together as he sees fit. But I was looking really toward the question of value, which is more akin to compensation or pay. I wanted to address the specific topic of, do we as mothers, particularly for those of us who have left the professional world, and this is a huge transition, for those of us who have given that up, are we actually receiving value? Are we receiving pay in a different format? And what I had to find was that there are elements of value and compensation in motherhood that are so distinctly different from those we acquire out in the working world. I went from short-term, immediate, tangible benefits to long-term, intangible, invisible benefit. And it's the only job in the world where you make a daily investment and then cross your fingers and say a prayer that they will maybe say please and thank you and eat their broccoli when they become 18. So it is really the most attenuated job that we can have, but it's also the most important. And this was really a compare and contrast. The first half of the book is addressed to where I was professionally, and I also had dabbled in education. I taught business ethics for a while as an adjunct and also worked in-house at an advertising agency, and it's one of those positions where, you know, I could kind of change career paths with the changing of the wind. And when you're a mother, it is the only job you can never quit, regardless of how hard, how monotonous, how underappreciated, and there will be no one for whom you will come home at the end of the day and they will say, hey, nice job on that spaghetti, Mom. Really appreciate it. And also, my clothes are clean, so thanks for that. You don't get any of that from your children. Maybe when they're older, you get that, but you have to make peace with the investment, the potential monotony, the unchanging landscape of the daily doing of things that will have a long-term impact and the most impact you can possibly have. You are leaving a mark on humanity behind you forever.
Right. Now, you mentioned there's sometimes conflict among some people that has come to be known as the mommy wars. Can you explain to us what the mommy wars are?
So this is a unique sort of construct of motherhood, and I don't know if it's particularly because women are potentially more insecure. We are creatures who are driven so relationally, whereas men, for the most part, are driven more vocationally, more professionally. But I haven't found this to be any different within the church than it is outside of the church. But when I was a professional, I didn't suddenly one day wake up screaming, you know, I hate falafels, the way I woke up when I was a mother and went, oh, it cannot be formula. I have to nurse. Or, you know, there is no hope sleeping. This baby will be fervorized and has to sleep in the crib. And I think what motherhood does, because it is such a unique but intense life experience, and it can only be shared by other women who have walked that journey, it takes those potential insecurities and injects them with steroids. So now all of the potential options in the world are narrowed down to the one life choice you share with the 2 billion or so other mothers on the planet, and you find yourself believing that your choices are the best, when in actuality, I do believe God gives us this exceptional insight, this premonition that it's really the Holy Spirit telling us what I am laying on your heart, that predilection you have, that choice you're making, that inclination, that mother's sixth sense is really Him saying to us, I am giving you what you need to make this choice. And so my philosophy has been from the outset, there are too many chips of meanness we hold against each other, and it's just a form of insecurity in the body that is no more different than it is outside the body, and it's something we have to give up so that we can flourish together in this incredibly important job.
I'm going to ask you a question, a wild card question as a man. What is the difference between how a mother experiences fatherhood, a mother experiences parenthood, and a father experiences it, as you see it?
Well, I will say, according to the Census Bureau, we are doing still more work than the men when it comes to child rearing, and that's perfectly fine. I have no problem with that actual family illustration whatsoever. We are doing less housework than we are in 1965, by the way, but as of 2014, we are actually spending more time with our kids and less time on housework, which is perfectly fine with me. I will settle for a dirty house and better kids any day.
Yeah.
But I believe, really, the way we are put together is particularly unique. And I reference many times in this book, Sub Turkle's book, Working, which is people talking about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. And Turkle decided it was important enough, and this is a man who...
We've only got about 30 seconds left, Sarah.
He wrote about housewives, took an entire chapter, and he said, what is it about your job that you value? And his essential completion was that this is the mark we leave on humanity. Everyone's goal is to be remembered. Wow. Motherhood is the ultimate job behind which we leave proof that we have lived. And that's
great.
What's so important.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah Perry, author of Sand in My Sandwich and Mommy Needs a Raise. Check them out on Amazon. Thanks for joining us this week.
Adios.
See you again on Monday.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.